Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be shining the spotlight on the great English Cardinal John Henry Newman. That's with Monsignor Roderick Strange. And then I'll be quizzing our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster, about the particular charism of his order. Doing some browsing in your local bookshop any day soon? If you do, you might just come across a book by the title of John Henry Newman, A Mind Alive. You won't miss it. It has a sepia-coloured photograph of an intense-looking Newman on the cover. A photograph which, in my opinion, conveys two things. First of all, that mind alive, enhanced by that sharp glint of the eyes, but also a warmth, an intimacy, as this august figure leans, arms crossed, towards, well, us, really.
The mind was alive not because he was some icy intellectual locked in a tower, but because he didn't want to move minds without touching hearts.
Newman in a nutshell. As the author of the book, Monsignor Roderick Strange, currently rector of the Pontifical Beda College here in Rome, remarked to me. A Newman expert, this Rome-based Monsignor, who, as you can read on the blurb on the back cover of this paperback, published by Darton, Longman and Todd, paints a vivid and nuanced portrait of this Englishman, who happens to be one of the most significant and enigmatic figures of the 19th century. One already proclaimed venerable in 1991, who may soon be declared blessed. I invited Monsignor Strange to join me here at our studios. He sat down with me to speak about his book. But before letting you enjoy this conversation, I'd like you to listen to a couple of lines from page one of the book. A quotation of Newman's about God's hidden saints and their influence.
Say they are few, such high Christians, and what follows? They are enough to carry on God's noiseless work.
He himself said, you know, that you don't have to call Whitey Brown white when you're talking about the saints. And Pope Benedict, in January 2007, spoke about the fact that people are canonized doesn't mean that they've never made mistakes.
Perché vediamo i santi non sono caduti santi dal cielo. Erano uomini come noi, con problemi anche con peccati. Ma...
They've not fallen from heaven.
They've got problems. One of the things which could be valuable about Newman being beatified, we would hope later canonized, would be that he would be an example to people who struggle, whose lives are a bit complicated, a bit messy at times, and that's all right. You know, it's really the way we handle the mess rather than having everything perfect all the while.
Getting on to the scholarly side of things, on the cover of your book, I read his personality remains elusive. What does that mean?
It's a way of referring to the complexity of the personality. You know, somebody who was, in many ways, quite solitary, very happy in his own company, and yet also a man who had a great capacity for friendship, got on well with all sorts of different people. There's a book written by a friend of mine, Joyce Sugg, which is really based on the letters that Newman wrote to a whole range of women friends, rather aristocratic ladies, ordinary women, his sisters, some nuns, a whole range of people. Great capacity for friendship, for engaging with people.
Yeah, he's best known as a scholar, really, isn't he?
That's what people remember, or people often associate him with. But one of the things that I think is interesting about Newman is the way in which the scholarship was always what he called occasional, not in the sense that he just did it from time to time, but in the sense that it was provoked by, prompted by particular occasions, particular needs. So there was always something very, very practical, very immediately pastoral about what he was concerned with. He had this saying, which I love, about not wanting to touch people's minds without moving their hearts, which is, I think, is at the very centre of what he was concerned with. To be real, to touch people where they really, where the problems really existed.
He lived at a time when you didn't speak about that sort of thing too much, no? Touching people's hearts for somebody of his standing.
Yeah,
not in Britain, anyway.
Perhaps not in some ways, though I suppose, you know, when you think of the Victorians, there's a tremendously rich literary tradition. Think of the great novelists of that time, the Trollope and Dickens and so forth. And theology and literature were very much interwoven in the 19th century. So that would have been sort of part of the air that he breathed, and therefore to touch people, to bring things home to people in a more immediate way was important for him.
So he was very complete in a sense, because you said he was human, he was saintly, you know, having erred sometimes.
Yeah.
Then he was a theologian, and he was a literary figure as well.
Very much, yes.
And a musician, no?
And indeed a musician. He loved music and played the violin.
So he was a good parish priest as well.
He was a good parish priest. The people who know not too much about him tend to make a much too oversimple contrast between himself and the other, his contemporary as a cardinal, Henry Edward Manning. Manning was the Archbishop of Westminster, also a convert Anglican clergyman. There are all sorts of parallels between their lives. But people tend to think of Manning as being the administrator and the practical man, and Newman the more reclusive theoretical scholar. The caricature isn't fair to either of them.
And perhaps this is because people haven't really read Newman.
More recently, perhaps not, yes. When you read books about Newman, quite often writers say that Newman was such a beautiful writer that they are going to leave him very often to speak for himself. Now, there are plenty of quotations in the book, but I've tried to break down, by and large, the big block quotations so that people reading the book will find it easier to get into and to understand what he was saying.
Your book offers a profile of a thinker, friend, and a priest. Which comes first for you, personally?
Personally?
Now the book's published.
Now the book's published. Newman has been, since I was a student here in Rome over 40 years ago, a real influence on my life. Not the only influence, but a significant influence on my life.
Why is that?
I think because when I started to read him, first of all, I thought his life story was very interesting because it's a story of expectations quite often not being fulfilled. He was expected to do very well as an undergraduate but virtually failed his degree. And then, surprisingly, he was made a fellow of what was regarded as the top Oxford College at the time when he became a don at Oriel, and then becoming involved in the Oxford movement, but then, in fact, becoming a Roman Catholic, and then the various problems that he had as a Catholic, sort of various crises that arose. So it's quite an exciting story in its way. That was one thing. And then another aspect was when I started to read Newman, it was during the Second Vatican Council in the mid-1960s. And that was a time, as you know, when the church here in Rome was coming to grips in a fresh way with a sense of local churches. And here was Newman, a quintessentially English figure. So he was fascinating for me as a young man preparing for priesthood in that way. And also what we've already talked about, that strong pastoral drive that really shaped everything that he did. He wasn't just a remote academic. I make the point in the book that although the subtitle is A Mind Alive, the mind was alive not because he was some icy intellectual locked in a tower, but because he didn't want to move minds without touching hearts and being involved with people.
And what's his legacy to the average Catholic today?
His legacy to the average Catholic today, average is always difficult, isn't it? But his legacy to the average Catholic, I think, would be, but to help them perhaps understand questions which they might puzzle over, whether they're questions of authority or the significance of Our Lady in ecumenical discussion, the place of the laity in the Church.
You have chapters about that,
chapters
don't you?
About that.
And, you have Mary, but also Mother of Jesus, serving the laity.
Yeah, but also I think attitudes to spirituality and just the example of faithfulness when things are difficult.
He was an Anglican who was received in the Catholic Church in 1845, I believe. He had a profound influence both on the thinking of Anglicans and Catholics, no?
He has had. I mean, obviously, there'll be both Anglicans and Catholics who are not impressed by him or not particularly enthused by him. People who find him too particular or too fussy, and that's all right.
But in chapter 7 you talk about seeking church unity.
Mm, yes, and particularly what I tried to show in that chapter is the way in which after Newman had become a Roman Catholic, after he'd left the Church of England, he remained particularly in regular contact with Edward Pusey, who had been a close friend of his as an Anglican, and they had been involved very much in the Oxford Movement, which was a movement to help the Church of England retain and develop its Catholic tradition. Newman became a Catholic, Pusey remained an Anglican, but they remained good friends, and they discussed matters. In particular, they got involved in a controversy about the way in which doctrine and teaching and devotion to the Blessed Virgin should be handled. But the fascinating thing is, although that they were holding, on the one hand, a public debate, they were also writing to each other privately. It's a wonderful example of people who, on the one hand, are conducting a public debate, and I don't mean in a secretive way, but in fact are in contact privately and trying to work out how to handle the dispute in the most constructive fashion.
An era of letters
rather than emails. But it's also a warning, because they didn't get all that far with it, but that personal trust is a vital feature in all ecumenical relationships, as in all human relationships, really.
In chapter 3 of your book, you speak about how Pope Benedict XVI viewed Newman both as Pope and as former Cardinal. What kind of influence do you think this great blessed-to-be then had on his thinking?
I think one influence, which the Pope has spoken about some years ago when he was cardinal here in Rome, was how, as a young seminarian just after the Second World War, he valued Newman's teaching on conscience. And he's spoken movingly about the importance. It's absolutely fundamental to Pope Benedict, isn't it, of the importance of reason, not in the narrow, sort of dry intellectual sense, but that we should be reasonable, we should explore and try to discover objective truth, that if everything becomes relative, then it's not that, well, you can think what you like and I can think what I like and everything is free, but on the contrary, it will mean that the people who have power force their own conclusions on people. And that, of course, was precisely the experience that he had had as a boy in Nazi Germany. So that he has spoken about Newman as articulating, so to speak, an alternative to that dictatorship that he had experienced when he was young.
Give me a good reason why anyone should read your book. Well, in your opinion?
I hope that when people read it, that they will find that it's not nearly as difficult to read as they might have expected. That, if you like, Newman's friendly face on the cover is in fact quite a good sign of what they're going to find inside. And that from the book they will discover something of him as a human being, something of the way in which he thought about matters which are still crucial for us in the Church today. And because there is a personal element there, in other words, I've mentioned from time to time ways in which what he has said have been of help to me, then they may be able to transpose that and see, not that he would necessarily help them in the way that he's helped me, but that this is not just some figure from the distant past, but somebody who really does have something which is significant for us still today.
Warm thanks there to Monsignor Roderick Strange, author of John Henry Newman, A Mind Alive. And finally, as announced earlier, it's time for our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who tells us today about the particular charism of his order. Father Foster, you're a Carmelite, right? How do you say Carmelite?
Carmelita.
Carmel is a prominent landmark in northern Israel at a remote and inaccessible height. Is that right?
Well, it's on the top of a mountain. It's a Mount Carmel. It's a mountain over Haifa, overlooking Haifa.
First part of the word, it comes from the Hebrew, no? A word meaning vineyard or a garden.
Yeah, exactly. The of gardens.
And the suffix El takes on the meaning of garden of the Lord, but in Hebrew. So how would you say all that in Latin?
Suffixum archivit vim ex lingua hebraica. Vim divinam.
Vim.
Vim, power, force.
Is that why the soap used to be called vim?
Well, certainly. What they you wash your bathroom with is... Or when someone has vim and vigor. Those are two Latin words just right there.
So you're connected, I discovered by looking around about the Carmelites, that you're connected to Elijah.
Yeah, he's considered our spiritual father.
I didn't know that.
Well, if you go to St. Peter's Basilica, you have a massive statue of Elias.
Where?
In the main aisle of St. Peter's.
I've never seen it.
Well, you should, on the right-hand side.
On his chariot.
No, he's not. He's standing there. And it's really there. It's a... Omnium Carmelitarum Pater, the father of all Carmelites.
Where is it exactly?
It's around the third or fourth statue on the right-hand side of the main aisle. Massive thing, about 20 feet big. Title below is the father of all Carmelites, spiritual father.
He was pursued into the desert by his enemies, and after a 40-day journey, he was left in the depths of failure, loneliness, and despair.
Oh, yeah, well, that wasn't why he's the with the Carmelites.
So what's he got to do with Carmelites?
Because of what they call the duplicem spiritum. He had a double spirit, which is which I like about the Carmelites to this day.
What does that
Namely,
mean?
Namely, when I go home now, I'm a hermit. No one comes in, no one bothers, no noise, no nothing.
How do you say that?
But when I'm outside, I'm very active and busy.
Okay, can you say all that to me in Latin?
Baptis verbis. Bene, cum domi sum tamquam anacoretusum. Sed foris cum versor sum actuosissimus. I'm very active when I'm outside. Well, that was the thing with Elias. He would go in his cave and pray for a couple months and then come out and kill all the enemies of the Lord, like 500 of them.
Well, killing is never...
That was kind of a job or an exhausting thing, and then he'd go back to his cave.
Yeah, but fighting...
And then the Lord, don't worry about it. And then the
Lord... I want to worry about it. You're just telling me that your spiritual father is someone who went around killing people.
No, I said he was given assignments by God. And then he'd come out and be very active, and when it was over with, he'd go back to his cave and pray... And so, that's the ideal of the Carmelites, really, to this day, the double spirit.
Is that what you really liked about the
charism? That's why I entered.
The charism.
Yeah, absolutely. I haven't given up. What is it going to be? 49, almost 50 years that I'm in the order. But I like the idea that turn the thing on and off, you see. I mean, I can run around all day long. When I go home, bang, that's the end of it. Silence, peace, prayer, meditation, and that's the double spirit. I mean, some people turn their rooms or their monasteries into, like, you know, meeting halls. Oh, no.
How would you describe your charism in a few words in Latin?
Well, it's a duplex spiritus. It's a precautionis et actionis of prayer and activity.
Chiefly contemplative, involving enclosure and withdrawal from the world.
Exactly.
Okay? How do you say all that? Chiefly contemplative.
Resertim est umbratilis, well, contemplativa vita.
Involving enclosure and withdrawal.
Ah, ben, certissime. Clausuram amplectens et recessum amundo.
But some Carmelites actually live enclosed, don't they? They're cloistered Carmelites.
Oh, yeah, the sisters are.
Just the sisters?
Yeah, we don't have... Well, no. Well, we have what you call desert foundations.
Which are?
Like, you know, hermits. We have one in the United States in West Virginia, where they have little houses and they're five or six. And
that's not being a hermit, being five or six together.
No, I mean, they're living five or six are in five, six little houses. Mm. So we still have it, but it's the sisters who have the strict enclosure, which we don't. We don't have.
Would the Romans have understood that kind of life, the life of a hermit?
No, they probably wouldn't have understood it. But there were such people, like philosophers and stuff, you know, who would go off and be alone and run away from humanity in this wicked world and then come back and maybe teach and do something and then disappear. The Romans knew that people did this, but they wouldn't understand religiously. They wouldn't understand.
But do you think Cicero would have understood Elijah at all?
Yes, I think so.
When he was on his chariot of fire, or what?
A chariot of fire.
How do you say chariot of fire?
Curus igneus. Mm. That's in scripture.
Anyway, getting back to Cicero, do you think he would have understood Elijah, or?
He would have understood, like, a double way of life. I mean, which he himself did. I mean, he would be in the forum and in the Senate House giving speeches, and then maybe for a couple of months, nothing, and writing things at home in silence in the library. Well, they understood, you know, the switching on and off.
So how'd you say a switch? How would you say
permutatio, commutatio.
Anyway, switching to other Carmelite figures in the 16th century, but a Spanish mystic called St. Teresa of Avila.
Our foundress.
She's your foundress. And
they call her the Legifera Mater, the legislating mother. Of course, founded the nuns. And then she got some men to follow her idea.
Like St. John of the Cross.
Mm-hmm.
She was described as a restless, contumacious gadabout at one point.
Well, yes.
How do you say all that in Latin?
Inquieta et impudens vagabunda. Well, because she was running around Spain making foundations and all that stuff. And was involved in everything, writing to kings and queens and popes. And so she was quite...
Was the Carmelite double life she actually had?
And then she'd come home get off her jackass and become in the monastery and quiet and not do anything for a year.
What are other figures that you think are particularly significant for the Carmelites?
I mean, all of we have all of our giants there, Therese and...
Therese of Lisieux.
Yes.
The other Therese, and then Edith Stein more recently.
Yeah, the latest. Yeah.
And what's the other? Titus Brandsman.
Well, he's the other order. I mean, he's a Carmelite,
okay,
too.
Okay, we got that. He's not a Descalced Carmelite? Or
no, he's a Calced Carmelite.
So you're a Descalced Carmelite,
yes,
you have shoes on.
Yes, that's all gone. The name doesn't mean anything anymore. In the old days, in the 1500s, to be with unshod, got it, like sandals or barefoot, was a sign of a reform, that the order was reformed, and we belong to the reformation of the order.
The sign of poverty.
Well, it was a sign. It was an exterior sign. That's why you have discalced Augustinians. And all these people with sandals were supposed to be a sign of a reformed, this is the Council of Trent business, a reformed order. But anyway, now it was discalced, doesn't mean anything in English.
Of course, you have a Marian devotion too, which we haven't spoken about.
Well, yes, certainly.
That's, Our Lady that's, of Mount Carmel.
Oh, yeah, that goes way back to the beginning.
What can you tell me about it?
Well, I mean, that's why the old thing in the Old Testament, where they saw this little, like a cloud over Mount Carmel, and they always interpreted this as the presence of the Blessed Mother and so forth and so on. But as soon, no, they had this devotion to Mary. And when they came to Europe from Mount Carmel, they brought this tremendous devotion to Mary.
But why are you talking about the Old Testament?
Well, I mean, that's where the thing started. And they said this figure of the cloud and then the rain coming down, you know, after.
Can you explain all that to me in Latin?
No, right now.
Oh, come on,
no.
You can. Yes.
No.
Yes, you can.
Ec omnia explicantur. Beh. Said like nubes erat figura Virginis Mariae. The cloud erat figura of a forma Virginis Mariae. Cuius cultum Carmelite in Europam transtulerum. They brought it over into Europe. Very, very much ooh from the beginning. At Rivera, really, down to it, nos vocamur. Fratres Carmelitane Beatissime Virginis Maria, the Brothers of the Blessed Virgin Mary, is our official title from the 1200s.
But in the Ancient Testament, Jesus wasn't born.
No, I understand, but all these figures, and then the new, let's say the Christians in the New Testament, were looking for figures and predictions in the Old Testament, and found all these things, and one of them was the famous cloud there, Elias. And it was raining, and it rained, and so forth and so on. And they said this was a figure of the Blessed Virgin. But they were dedicated to her from the beginning. As I say, we are called Brothers of the Blessed Virgin Mary of Mount Carmel. That's our official title in the Annuario Pontificio.
Mm. So your initials are?
Well, now and now,
OCD. OCD.
Carmelitatum Discalciatorum.
Are there any fathers of the church who wrote about Elijah in a special way?
Oh, heaven's sakes, they all did. They all did because he was such a, I was saying, of course, then the priest of Baal, you know, that was one of his duties there. He had to kill off 300 pagan priests there. I know, and the sacrifice, and he says, in cuius conspectus sto, in the name of the Lord in whose presence I stand. This is all in the Old Testament.
Yeah, so but was, I mean, was, you shouldn't was, be killing people because of our Lord.
I understand, but if God tells you to kill them, then you have to do it. Well, that's what he did. What do you mean? Ach, they all did that. Anyway, and so he's a massive figure, really.
Heartfelt thanks there, as always, to Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. And that's all I have time for on today's broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now, and don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.